Welcome to a new week, and I hope you are planning on being with us all the sessions as we continue our study in the book of Revelation. And today we are going to pick our story back up in Revelation chapter 14, where we broke off last time, verse number 14. Now we're in the vision I refer to as the long war between the seed of the woman and the seed of the serpent, or the seed of the dragon. That war began in Genesis chapter 3, and it had a major victory in the story of Jesus' first coming, when he broke the power base of Satan. He was fulfillment of the Genesis 3:15 prophecy that the seed of the woman would crush the serpent's head, even as he was struck on the heel. We know that that vision then jumps fast ahead after the ascension of Jesus to the day of the Lord. And we're now getting prepped, getting ready for the seven wrath events to be repeated in this vision. And we will be emphasizing how we've already talked about them in the first vision, the vision of the scroll of God's final wrath. But in this section, chapter 14, we have what I have referred to as public service announcements. God gives information through his angels. And one of the key things was, don't take the mark of the beast. If you take the mark of the beast, that is the end. There's no coming back from that. And so this has now brought us to this climactic moment in the final 3.5 years where the side of the beast government, with the beast leader and his 10-horned kings and his false prophet, they are insisting you must take this mark, or you can't buy, you can't sell, and in fact, you will be counted as a traitor and executed. And then on the other side, God has publicly said through his angel to everyone, if you go ahead and take this mark, you will be condemned to the judgment that is coming upon the beast leader's kingdom, and eternal judgment beyond that. So everybody now has to make a choice. Which side are they going to listen to? And a lot of people are going to refuse the mark, and they will die. And I think that is what we're going to see described in the imagery of Revelation 14, 14 following. Revelation 14, 14. Then I looked, so this is still John acting as a seer. He's seeing things and describing them. Behold, a white cloud, and seated on the cloud, one like a son of man. Now, son of man is a term that basically means human. But we know also that it gets used prophetically of Jesus, especially if it's a son of man seated on a cloud, because in the Daniel passage, chapter number 7, we see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of glory. And so I would submit to you that this is Jesus, but he's not coming yet. He does not come until after the seven wrath events have been poured out. So what is he doing instead? He is seated on a cloud like with a golden crown on his head. And this crown is again, the Stephanos, the victor's crown. So Jesus has overcome and has such a crown. And a sharp sickle in his hand. Now, what's a sickle for? It is to cut stalks of grain to bring in a harvest. Another angel came out of the temple. And of course, this is the temple in heaven. We've talked about the idea that pretty much throughout the book of Revelation, the temple is always the one in heaven. It's the throne room of God. So this other angel comes out of the temple, calling with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud. So this is to Jesus. And apparently this angel is coming with a directive from the Father. Put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, for the harvest of the earth is fully ripe. And so he who sat on the cloud swung his sickle across the earth, and the earth was reaped. Now, I think some people get confused and think that this is talking about somehow the end of the world itself, and I do not think so. I would suggest that this should be understood that when people start dying because they side with Jesus against the beast leader, they are killed in large numbers because of that. And this is the harvest of martyrs. This is a harvest of souls being brought by Jesus into his presence. They're being killed by human agents, but Jesus is the one that's collecting them into his eternal presence. Because we all know, as the scripture says, to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. So this is the harvest of souls, and I want you to keep that in mind when we go to something in a little bit here where I'm going to talk about the symbolism of the harvest, the symbolism of the different agricultural activities on the Jewish calendar. Now, verse 17 switches to a secondary harvest. Then another angel came out of the temple in heaven. So here he comes from the holy place, from the Holy of Holies. He too had a sharp sickle. So he has his own implement for collecting in a harvest. And another angel came out from the altar. Now, the altar that we've been talking about is often the prayer altar, where the martyrs of the past have been praying, God, how much longer till you avenge us? And God's response was, a little bit longer. And that little bit longer seems to be a reference to the 3.5-year period. So this other angel had the authority over the fire. Fire is often a symbol of judgment. He called with a loud voice to the one who had the sharp sickle, so the second being, that is the angel, and said, put in your sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, for its grapes are ripe. So instead of grain this time, we're focused on clusters of grapes. So the angel swung his sickle across the earth and gathered in the grape harvest of the earth and threw it into the great winepress of the wrath of God. And by the way, this is where the term grapes of wrath originates, which gets used in a story about the American Depression era. But here, the context is clearly sin has reached its peak where something needs to be done. The wrath of God needs to fall. And so that again puts us right before the seven wrath events begin. God has given leeway up to this point, but no more. It is now time for the wrath to be harvested and pressed. Verse 20, the winepress was trodden outside the city, and blood flowed from the wine press as high as a horse's bridle for 1,600 stadia. Now, each stadia is 607 feet. So we're talking about 184 miles. Now, which city? Well, it's probably the city codenamed Babylon. And I believe this might be another one of the indicators of the destruction of the city of Rome right before the seven wrath events are poured out, before they're trumpeted. Because Rome seems to be the codename city of Babylon, for Babylon. Now, eventually, as I've already indicated to you, I think literal Babylon will get into the mix. I believe that the beast leader starts out running things out of Rome area, but eventually, after they're ready to inaugurate the beast image system, the mark system, the image system, that they'll destroy Rome and then move to the Middle East, or in association with destruction of Rome, will move to the Middle East. So I believe the city in mind here is codename Babylon, probably Rome. The imagery, don't take it too literally. We see this in other Jewish literature of the time period to talk about widespread death and destruction, where blood is spattered as high as, not that the horse is swimming in a river of blood, but the blood is spattering up so high from death that it's coming as high as the horse's bridle. And then the destruction zone is a little bit hard to pin down, I think, because is this a straight line measurement? Is it to be taken as the diameter of a destruction shadow? In which case, we're talking about, 90-some miles from the center in all directions. And so that gets us up to the 184 miles. And I don't know. My opinion, and that's all it's worth, folks, my opinion is that when the beast leader and the 10 kings that are associated with him, whom we know hate the woman riding on the back of the beast, the false religion, when they don't see a need for her any longer, which I think is going to be right around the time they initiate the mark, they will destroy her with fire. And so I think this might be the description of that, with a destruction zone radiating outward from the destroyed city of Rome. And that brings us to chapter number 15, which is going to introduce us to the seven last plagues, just like we had the seven last trumpets. And so these will be parallel. Remember, when a trumpet is sounded, that is a signal to pour out. So they kind of match perfectly together. Before we go into that, I want to delve into something highly speculative, but something that I find intriguing personally, and which you might also find intriguing and perhaps even a little helpful in digesting some of these things. And that is related into the Jewish calendar system. We know that when Israel was taken out of Egyptian bondage and taken off to Mount Sinai, and then ultimately they were to go into the Promised Land, that it happened in the spring. Up to this point, pretty much all the ancient Middle Eastern cultures, including the Semite cultures, kept a fall starting calendar. And that changed, or at least was modified, by the Jews being redeemed out of Egypt in the spring. In fact, when you read in the books of Moses, God specifically says, this will be the beginning of months for you, and you will keep certain observations or certain observances on a regular basis from here on out. Now, the Jewish people in the law of Moses were told that every adult male of reasonable health and living inside the boundaries of the Promised Land was expected to come to the sanctuary, the temple, the tabernacle before that, 3 times a year as part of a public assembly of Israel. The observances or the days of festival that account for those 3 events are Passover and its unleavened bread. That's in the first month of the year. The second one was Pentecost, which happened always at the very beginning of the 3rd month of the Jewish year. And the third one was the Feast of Tabernacles, which happened at the beginning of fall, the 7th month of the Jewish year. And these mandatory feasts were then fulfilled or started to be fulfilled by the actions of Jesus and his Holy Spirit in the church era. And here's the way that it happened. The first one is the day of Passover, and it is associated with other events previous to it, starting on the 10th day of the first month. The 10th day of the first month was the day that all Jewish people were supposed to designate their Passover lamb to be sacrificed or butchered 4 days later. Interestingly enough, as I'm about to show, Jesus fulfilled all the symbolism of these events, these dates, on the exact day on the Jewish calendar. So on the 10th day of the first month, that's the day Jesus entered Jerusalem in what we usually refer to as the triumphal entry, and he came as the Passover lamb designate. 4 days later, on the 14th, when the Passover lambs were being butchered, Jesus was dying on the cross as the ultimate and final Passover lamb. So he came in on the 10th day as the Passover lamb designate. He died on the 14th day as the Passover designate. On the first day of the week that falls during the Feast of Unleavened Bread, which is the 15th through the 21st of the first Jewish month, that's the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and always on the Sunday that falls during that week, the high priest was to go out into the field and cut the first sheaf of grain, it would have been barley, out of the field. He was to bring it with pomp and circumstance up to the tabernacle or the temple, and then he was to wave it in front of God's presence as a first fruits offering, so that everybody understood the whole harvest is coming in because of God, and we thank him with this first fruits offering. Now, Jesus resurrected from the dead on that exact day, the Feast of First Fruits, the Sunday that fell during the week of unleavened bread in that year. And so he became the first fruits of those resurrected permanently from the dead. And first fruits always indicates there's something big coming. There's more yet to come. So we know that our resurrection one of these days, or our transformation, is a follow-up to Jesus' own resurrection and transformation. So everything up to this point has happened exactly on the specific date that Jesus fulfilled that aspect of the symbolism. Now, on that Feast of First Fruits, that became day one of a 50-day count to Pentecost. Pentecost means 50-day count. And this is what would happen with the agricultural cycle. The barley harvest could not begin until the first fruits ceremony on that Sunday that fell during unleavened bread. So the barley harvest began on the Monday that followed the Sunday. You couldn't go out and work in your fields to harvest the barley until that holiday happened. 50 days after the first fruits offering, Pentecost was another ceremony of taking, this time, wheat and designating it as a gift from God and the beginning of the wheat harvest. And so on that day, we see the church getting started and the first people putting their faith in Jesus Christ as their sacrificial lamb and their resurrected Lord and Savior. And so Pentecost is all about the start of a harvest of souls coming into the kingdom. And it happened exactly on the day of Pentecost. Now, the day after Pentecost on the Jewish calendar was the first day you could actually go out and work your fields and start harvesting the wheat. And that harvest would go on for several months. And all of that grain that you processed would eventually, be put in storage. And part of it would then be taken to the next big festival to be given as part of the tithe. And that next big festival was the Feast of Tabernacles. And it happened in the fall. And it was all about the harvest is in, and now we are ready to celebrate. Now, here's the interesting thing, and this is where I need you to really pay attention. Jesus fulfilled all the aspects of the first festival, that is, the Passover unleavened bread, by being the lamb designate on the 10th, the actual Passover lamb on the 14th, and then the first fruits offering on the Sunday that followed. So he fulfilled all of those on the exact same day that they symbolized. 50 days after the resurrection, the church gets started on the feast of Pentecost, which marks the beginning of the great grain harvest of wheat. And the people are often referred to as God's wheat. And Jesus even said, unless a grain of wheat dies and is put into the ground, it cannot bear much fruit. And that was clearly a reference to his death and resurrection, producing a great harvest of souls. But eventually, the harvest has to be gathered in. And then Feast of Tabernacles comes. Now, Feast of Tabernacles does not have any sort of New Testament fulfillment. There is nothing that we can pin it down to as to an event in church history that's already happened. That is why I suspect the Feast of Tabernacles is associated with the second coming of Jesus. and us being in his eternal presence. The harvest being over, which is the harvest of souls, and we will be in his presence forever and ever. And it is interesting to me that the final chapter in the book of Zechariah, Zechariah chapter 14, mentions the Feast of Tabernacles in direct association with what is clearly the millennial period. Jesus Christ has already come. The Battle of Armageddon has already taken place. All of that has happened in chapters 12, 13, and the beginning of 14 in the book of Zechariah. And then and only then do you see the mention of the Feast of Tabernacles. So it is my thinking, and that's all it is. It's not a, I am a prophet of the Lord and I'm telling you this is the way it's going to be. It's just Thomas telling you, I suspect, I think that the last mandatory festival of the Jewish people will be fulfilled in connection with the second coming of Jesus. A couple of other things before we run out of time. Did you know that the seventh month, which is the month which Tabernacles takes place in, the first day of the seventh month is referred to as the Feast of Trumpets? Wouldn't it be interesting if Jesus has his angels sound the seventh trumpet, the last trumpet, on the first day of the seventh month, and that that will be the day that Jesus returns? Did you also know that the 10th day of the seventh month is called Yom Kippur? It is the Day of Atonement, and it is a day of somber reflection. And do you know what they're supposed to be thinking about? If I do not have the sacrifice of the Lamb, the sacrificial system of God saving me, I will pay with my own blood. I wonder, folks, if we can pin that to a specific future event.